Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jade Portman, and today our special guest is Jared Drysdale, a designer, writer, author of multiple books and courses on design, and we're going to talk about teaching design theory. This episode is brought to you by Balsamic Mockups. A Balsamic customer recently called it the only wireframing tool that doesn't make me feel stupid. Try it free for 30 days at balsamic.com. You'll be productive in no time. Hey, Jared.
Hey, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Well, we are thrilled to have you here. So we're going to start with a short blitz questionnaire so that we can learn where you come from and how you started. Great. And question number one is, what do you do for a living these days?
Yeah, so I'm a designer. I've been a designer for, I think, 12 years now. And so I've had a lot of different experiences over my career. I've worked at various ad agencies earlier on, but the second half of my career, I've been self-employed. So I've kind of written some books on my own and self-published them, and I also do consulting work on the side. So I have, right now I have, I kind of split my time in half between client work and my own product business.
Mm-hmm. Sounds great. What kind of consulting do you do? What do you focus on?
It's actually kind of all across the board. I'm a generalist, so I do a lot of design work, mostly web design work, but I also do copywriting and front end development for my clients when they need it. So I try to be a one-stop shop for,
awesome.
For them. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's great when a designer knows about writing and sales and marketing. That's really, they should be proud of you, your clients.
Thank you.
How did you get there? Well, I guess you told about that. Well, maybe a bit more about your early days as a designer.
Yeah. So early on, I actually went to design school. I went to a tiny liberal arts college in Oklahoma that nobody's ever heard of. And I graduated with a design degree. And I realized while I was still in college that I just wasn't learning the things that I needed to know in order to get a job when I graduated. So I taught myself Flash and how to code and started building, you know, websites in my free time. And by the time I graduated, I managed to build up a pretty, you know, well-rounded portfolio of websites. And I managed to land an agency gig right out of college, which was pretty tricky because it was a small city. You know, Oklahoma City is it's not a tiny city, but it's, you know, it's a small city for the number of universities that are there. So, and at the time, there weren't a lot of agencies. There were only a couple of agencies. So all the design jobs were there was a lot of competition. So I had to work really hard to kind of pick up those skills. And I ended up getting hired because of that generalist skill set that I was talking about. You know, I could kind of fill any need the agency had. I could build the websites. I could design them. And so that was how I got my first job. And then while I was still in college, we had a guest lecturer come and visit and do portfolio critiques for the seniors. And I ended up kind of staying in touch with that guest lecturer, and he ended up offering me a job about a year out of college. So I moved to Chicago and worked in Chicago at a couple different agencies for a few years. And then I moved here to Denver and was working at an agency in Boulder, Colorado. And a couple of years after I started there, I quit my job and started working for myself. I read the book Getting Real by 37 Signals, Jason Fried and David Hennemeyer Hansen, and kind of got the itch to make my own products. So I quit and started doing some freelance work and building my own products.
Well, that's a fantastic story. Well, you have you have all kinds of necessary background, actual formal education, which is a rare case for, you know, self-taught people, and then a lot of agencies and freelance. Fantastic. So these days, what does your typical day look like?
Typical? I don't really have a typical day, honestly. I try to switch it up. So usually I try to divide, you know, devote an entire day to client work and then devote an entire day to product work. And I try to schedule my days like that because it's just easier for me to have kind of one focus each day. So a typical day might be, you know, starting work around 9 a.m. And I like to do my creative work first thing, you know, get the most creative work done right off the bat, because I find that if I open up email and start, you know, coordinating and doing project management and writing proposals and stuff like that first thing, it drains me pretty quickly and I end up without too much creative energy later in the day. So that's really the only consistent thing I would say day to day, is that I try to get that creative focus first thing right off the bat.
Mm-hmm. What do you enjoy the most and the least about your work?
I enjoy the most just the freedom that I have to kind of bring my vision and my ideas into the world. You know, I think that's the greatest thing about being a designer, is you can have these ideas and you can actually bring them to life. And it's a very cool feeling to put something you've made online and see other people using it. It's just the coolest feeling in the world. As for what I like least, I think probably the project management aspect, you know, dealing with, you know, scheduling and estimating and writing proposals and all those kind of coordination and all that type of stuff that you have to do in order to do the creative work. Sometimes it feels like that that housekeeping type of stuff almost gets in the way of the fun creative work. And, you know, it's always a struggle for me to try and keep that balanced and keep things moving and make sure everybody's on the same page about deadlines and stuff like that. It's really hard work, and it can kind of kill the creative mood sometimes. So I have to be really careful about how I manage my schedule and my workload to make sure one doesn't start taking over the other. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Exactly. So the question, last question is, what is your next big thing? But I guess I know, it's your new awesome design course. Tell us more about it.
Yeah, so I've been working on a design course for a few months now. It's called Theory Sprints. And the concept is, it's kind of getting back to the fundamentals about learning design. I think a lot of new designers, when they're first starting out, they really struggle to find those kind of foundational techniques and principles, because so many of the design blogs are writing about more advanced strategies like UX design and design thinking and jobs to be done and responsive design and things that are really a lot more complex. And those strategies are really kind of hard to pull off until you have a solid foundation in the really important visual design principles. So I've been working on this design course that teaches those principles, but then it takes it a step further than you see in most design books and actually shows you how to use them. So there's about 4 hours of video demonstrations in the course where you see me creating an entire design from scratch, and I'm talking through every tiny decision that I make. And that's the kind of experience you can only really get when you're working under someone with more experience. So the goal is to train newer designers and maybe even more experienced designers who never got that kind of education in how to use those principles and how to make decisions based upon those principles, rather than just kind of learning by trial and error and going by your gut.
Yeah, that's gonna be a great course. Congratulations on getting close to launch.
Yeah, so it's launching on May 6th, so we're getting pretty close here. I'm really excited.
I think it's going to be out afterwards, so it's already going to be live when the episode is out.
Oh, okay. That's great. Okay.
So, main topic is teaching design. You are the author of Bootstrapping Design,
yes. I think.
Is that the correct title?
Yes.
Then you did a pretty big thing called The Tiny Designer.
Yes.
And now you are in your third iteration of teaching design to people, and you must have figured out by now. So can you tell us a bit about your evolution of thinking and maybe the approach you took originally that proved right or wrong?
Yeah. So the first book, Bootstrapping Design, it was a design book meant for programmers who are building software businesses, so bootstrappers. And the idea was, you don't have to hire a designer, you can create a good enough design on your own. And so I started out by kind of teaching the basics about design, you know, what are grid systems and how to pick good typography and how to create good typography and use color schemes and just kind of walking through some basic strategies about how to use those design principles. And the idea was that programmers could get quite a decent design together just by using those kind of foundational ideas. And that book ended up doing really well. I ended up selling several thousand copies, and it made about 6 digits in sales. And I realized after doing that book that the very practical approach that I have to design about, you know, using principles and, you know, just sitting down and doing the work rather than talking about the big ideas has kind of resonated with people. So that's what I'm trying to do with the new course, is kind of continue in that vein with the kind of practical focus on what do you sit down, what do you do when you sit down at your desk, you know, what are you supposed to, what's the first step when you're staring at that blank screen, you know, so how do you actually use those fancy sounding ideas that everybody's talking about with design? How does that actually translate to making something real? And I think maybe that's a little bit different from some things you see in the design industry, because designers are maybe in some ways dreamers, right? We like to think big and have these big ideas. And a lot of times we talk about our work in these kind of big ways, but it's hard for people to get a sense of what is that work really like, you know? So I've learned since writing that first book that the really practical approach is, I think, the best way for people to learn. And then, you know, I'm a big advocate of picking up some basic knowledge and then just practicing, because there is nothing that can really, as a designer, there's nothing that can really replace experience. You know, having made designs makes you better at making more designs. So I really encourage strongly that people just use what they learn and make mistakes and don't beat yourself up for making versions that you're not happy with. Just keep going.
Yeah, that's a great story. With the Tiny Designer, were you teaching, that was, I think, dedicated to client work and the actual client process. Can you tell a bit more about your approach to teaching that?
Yeah, you bet. So the Tiny Designer started out as actually two email series that were teaching kind of basic design principles. One was to designers and one was to non-designers. And the idea was that non-designers would be able to kind of demystify a little bit of what we designers do, because it can kind of seem like this mysterious thing, right? Like, we're creatives and we just go away, we disappear for a while and we come back with this shiny new design. Well, what did we do that whole time, you know? So it's trying to get those two sides to kind of understand one another. And so I launched that and it ended up getting like 6,000 or 7,000 subscribers, and which was really amazing and I never expected. And I turned that into a book. And the plan originally was to create the same thing, one book for each audience. I ended up only doing one for non-designers. And basically what it did was, again, just try to demystify design and what designers do and how to work with designers, how to get the most out of working with a designer. So that was that book. And it got into a lot of design principles as well, but not just that, also, you know, what designers do when we sit down at our desks and what the design process should look like, and how a client can be involved in the design process. I'm very inclusive in my design process, and I think a lot of newer designers are hesitant to do that. They're afraid to show early ideas to clients, and they're worried that somebody is going to step in and, you know, tell them to make the logo bigger or move this here or make this button green or whatever. But I try to involve clients really early on and get those ideas out and invite them into the brainstorming process and invite them to share their creative ideas, because I find that if they're invited early on, they won't surprise me later on with ideas that they're asking me to do. You know, I see fewer revision requests and fewer change requests later on in the project when I involve clients early on and keep things really open at the beginning of the project. So that was kind of the process that I taught with the Tiny Designer stuff. And then I actually wrote another book that followed that, that I did under a different name, but it was for designers. It was called Off the Chopping Block. And
oh, right. I'm sorry. I forgot about it. Super productive person.
No worries. Yeah. There's too many to keep track of for me, honestly. But, you know, that one didn't earn too many sales, which is probably why you forgot about it. But the book Off the Chopping Block was kind of about the same thing, about how to work with clients and how to negotiate revision requests. And I went through 9 different methods about how to respond to feedback and how to talk to clients and how to involve them in your process so that you're able to kind of stand up for your creative concepts and deliver your work intact. Because I think a lot of designers have this fear that when they deliver that first design, they're going to get a bunch of change requests and the end result is something that they're not happy with. So how to negotiate that entire process when you're working with other people and how to kind of explain your ideas and show that your decisions are, you're making your decisions with a reason and that it's not just a gut feeling, you know. So that was kind of the continuation of the tiny designer idea.
Mm-hmm. When you define the agenda for your education product, do you just sit down and think of what you want to write and tell people? Or do you use any other methods of collecting ideas for your courses?
I have a lot of methods, actually. So I think the biggest thing...
I'd love to hear about them, yeah.
Yeah. So I think the biggest thing that I use is just conversations I have with my audience. That's the biggest thing. I've been writing about design now for, good grief, probably 5 or 6 years. So I've had a newsletter for like 5 years. And, you know, I've been talking with all kinds of different people who want to learn about design, you know, including clients and developers and designers and all kinds of different people. So I'm always having these email conversations with people about, you know, problems they're having and giving them some advice and learning about what their challenges are. And those things, while I don't, you know, write one product based on one customer, I, over time, I get a sense of what a lot of people in that audience are facing. And right now, I've really shifted my business more to focus on designers. In the past, I've, you know, worked more for clients and more for, you know, like that tiny designer book was meant for people who hire designers. And then Bootstrapping Design was meant more for programmers. Now I'm focusing mainly on designers. And so I've been having a lot of email conversations with designers, and I've realized that a lot of people who are emailing me are saying things like, well, I want better clients and I want to get a job at this dream agency, you know, and I look at their work and it's just really not good enough. They don't have that kind of foundational knowledge in design to bring their work up to the quality level where they can unlock those opportunities. So that's just an example of, you know, how I pull a product concept out of those types of conversations.
And right. Then,
yeah, mm-hmm. Go ahead.
You mentioned that audience transformation that you kind of overcome over the years, and that's a super important topic because when you set out to produce some content, be it educational or just blogging or whatever you want to do as a designer, you have to decide who you are targeting. And you can decide to target people like yourself, which you ended up doing, or you can target people like your clients, which makes a natural fit because then you can kind of pull your clients from that audience. Is there any reason why you shifted towards actual designers just because you want to teach the craft and not the process?
Yeah, for a lot of reasons, really. I found that designers are really more invested in learning design, and that's honestly the biggest reason. They take it more seriously and they're more committed to it. You know, I think teaching design to non-designers is still valuable, but I feel like I've done that. You know, I have that writing out there and I took that as far as I could. So I'm looking for a new challenge now. And I have had a lot of contact with designers. And one thing that surprised me was that even when I was writing a book about design for programmers, I had a lot of designers buying it. And I realized that there was a big opportunity there with teaching designers. So, you know, over time, I realized that was the best route to go. I've also had a lot of marketing success for designers. I have a free ebook called Design's Iron Fist that I, you know, I offer as kind of a lead magnet on my website. You know, if people sign up for my email newsletter, they get the ebook for free. And that ebook has been plugged on a bunch of sites all over the web. And I found that when I write about design, it's a lot easier to get that writing in front of designers than other people who aren't reading about design as much. So it was just a marketing question. You know, it's just a lot easier to reach an audience who's already looking and reading about that topic.
Right, exactly. For example, I tried it with the UI audit book. I targeted founders, and what I learned during research is that they do care about design, but it's never a top priority for them. While designers, definitely care about their self-development and they want to become better at their craft. And I think also they're probably more designers just as a numeral thing on the internet as opposed to founders.
Right, right. Yeah. That's totally true. Yeah. I mean, the design community is huge. I mean, I don't even know. It's impossible to estimate. I mean, with all the big design blogs and websites, I mean, it's just a massive industry. So carving off a small piece of that industry is a lot easier, I think.
Mm-hmm. When I try to teach design, I kind of sometimes feel that I have not studied all possible academic things out there, and that like that imposter thing really kicks in sometimes. Do you experience that in your process?
Yeah, I do, because you know I've written about this before. Actually, I have a design degree, but I didn't learn the things I really needed to learn in design school. And I'm actually kind of a big critic of design, going to design school, you know, going to like a 4-year university or even a lot of the newer design boot camps. I've talked to graduates who they pay like thousands of dollars to go to these design boot camps, and then they come away and they don't even know like what proximity is or how to use a grid system and just basic things like that. So I don't have a problem with formal education. My problem is more with what people learn there. And I think that most of the designers you respect will tell you that they are largely self-taught, even if they do have a design degree. And I'm an example of that. So yeah, that imposter syndrome, I think it definitely creeps in. But I think when people tell me that, I just say, well, so am I. I think everybody is to some extent. And what matters in the design industry is not, well, do you have that piece of paper that says you're a designer? What matters is your work good? You know, can you design something well? And it's completely about skill. It's, you know, the design that you can get about, or I'm sorry, the knowledge that you can get about design is much less useful than all the time and effort that you put into building up that skill.
When we were talking about those methods, did you finish your idea, or did I interrupt you in the middle of your thought?
Oh, no, that was fine. Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, teaching design is really challenging, and there is, you know, there are a lot of different approaches to it, and I obviously have mine, and I try to be more practical about teaching design. And if people don't like that, there are other ways to learn. You know, there are the more theoretical places where you can learn about design thinking. And I'm kind of critical of those things because I think that some designers will graduate from those places and they won't really have the practical skills they need to go actually make a design. You know, they can make plans and they can create, you know, UX flows and things like that, but they can't actually create the visual design and bring it into the world. They can't actually launch it. So I think having those practical skills is just so important.
Absolutely. When you think about agenda for your course, like I know because I a couple years ago, I wrote a book for Envision, which was called Fundamental UI Design. So mm-hmm. I was lucky to avoid the marketing and just sit down and express my thoughts on design. And there's that huge gap between the essentials, the principles that we start with is, you know, empathy, blah, blah, blah. Then there goes color theory, proximity, and things like that. And there goes real life process. Do you have any specific ideas how to link these three in the education process?
Yeah, yeah. So the process that I teach in my course is basically to start everything out with research. You know, mm-hmm. you start everything with, and that's empathy, right? It's starting out by trying to understand who is going to be using the design? What do they want to accomplish? You know, what do they value? What kind of products do they purchase? What kind of design styles appeal to them? Trying to understand them as much as you can, because all of that knowledge will inform your decisions later. You know, your decisions about color theory and, you know, proximity and every other design principle, all those decisions should be informed by who is the person that's using that design. So I ground everything in research, and I'm a very results-driven designer, and I recommend that all designers try to think about how they can achieve results with their designs, because if you don't have a outcome in mind for your design, it's really difficult to defend any of your positions. You know, any decision you make can be called into question if you don't really have a strong outcome attached to it, right? Well, I think this logo looks good here. But people might say, well, what I think it'll look better over there. You know, if you don't have a really strong rationale for putting that logo in that spot will help guide people to, you know, perform the call to action, click on the button or whatever. You know, it really, it's just really difficult to defend your designs. So I always recommend that people start out with that foundation and research, creating goals for the design, and then use that as the foundation for everything else you do.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned your new course not entirely, but largely consists of actual video lessons where you break down your process and you explain your design decisions. I know that kind of content is probably the hardest to make, and it's also the most desirable for the audience. Because, like, if a designer sits down on a beautiful MacBook and just want to type away on, large-scale strategy, that's good. But those down-to-earth details are hard and interesting. Can you just tell us what principles is that based? Like, how do you approach this kind of exercise?
Yeah. So I can be kind of critical of design education, and I hope people don't think I'm harping on this, but I think a lot of times when you're looking at places to learn design, what you see is some talking head sitting there talking about theory and these abstract ideas. And then you leave and you're like, what do I do? I'm sitting here at my desk and there's a blank screen in Photoshop. What do I do first? You know? And it's hard to relate those abstract concepts down to what you sit down at your desk and do, kind of like I said earlier. And then the other thing that you get is just step-by-step tutorials. Well, here's how to create a blog design in Photoshop. Type in this headline, draw a box here, whatever. But you can't really use that to create your own designs. You only learned how to create that one little thing. So I was looking for a way to kind of give that missing piece. You know, I think what people are missing in design education is that thought process about all of those little decisions that you make when you're creating a visual design. So why did I make that button that size? And why did I make that button that color? And why did I make the text inside the button that color? And why did I put that button 30 pixels from the paragraph above it instead of 20 pixels? You know, things like that, those really tiny details. People don't really understand the reasoning for those. So the demonstration videos that I did, you see me in Photoshop moving things 10 pixels and talking about this is why I moved it that way. Or, you know, setting a headline at a certain font size and saying, well, this is why the headline needs to be a little bit bigger, because it needs to contrast the subheader enough so that they look like they're different font sizes, things like that. So I actually break the design course down into what I'm calling sprints. Theory sprints, which is where the name is from. Mm-hmm. And each topic, each sprint is about one design principle. So for example, the first one is the first one is process. And it talks about what the phases of your design process should be. And then the second one is planning. And I take the students through an entire planning process. What do you need to do when you're planning a project? So I start out by doing research, writing some copy, listing out specifications, and then sketching out interface concepts. Then the next one I work on, I can look here at the outline, it's typography. You know, so I start working on a typography system and picking fonts and comparing fonts and talking about all of the decisions that I make about what goes into font sizes and using font weights and creating, you know, the right size for paragraph text and all of that stuff. So I talk about all of those decisions for every design principle that I cover. So not only do you read a lesson about, you know, what is the stuff that you need to know about typography, what are serif typefaces and what are sans serif typefaces and, you know, kerning and all that stuff, you also see me using those principles and those ideas and applying them when I create a real design. And I think that is the thing that is really hard to find when you're learning design, because for me, at least, when I went to design school, I didn't get any of that. You know, I only got that kind of an education on the job when I was working on real projects and I had a creative director sitting at my desk saying, why did you do it that way? Try this instead. And I would try it and I would realize it looked better, right? But I didn't have any other way to learn. And I think that's what I'm trying to do with these video demonstrations, is showing those kind of granular decisions. And then you see over the 4 hours of video how in the end they really kind of snowball. And while, you know, the early ones are kind of boring, you see these like, okay, he moved something 10 pixels, you know, it sounds really boring. But by the end, all of those tiny decisions I've made have created a really nice design. And that's the kind of experience I think people need.
What about the process itself? It does have, you know, technical limitations. You just sit down. And when you sit down and start recording your design process, doesn't it lead to creative block? Because it definitely would for me, for example.
Yeah, that was a really big struggle, actually, creating design on camera. It was a very slow process, and having to explain every tiny thing that I was doing was actually a really big challenge. I didn't realize when I created the concept for this course how much it would actually slow me down. So yes, that was a really big challenge, and there were a couple times, I think in the color demonstration, I had to just stop a couple times and, you know, stop the recording and just think, okay, what am I doing here? You know, where am I heading with this? And take a pause. And in the video, I actually, there's like a little pause and I say, well, I took a break. I walked away from my desk and I came back and this is what I think. And I think you just have to do that sometimes. Even when I'm not recording, you know, when I'm not on camera, I have to do that with my designs. You know, take a break, you know, get some fresh air, come back and get, you know, come back to it with some new perspective. So, you know, it was kind of challenging, but it was a kind of a fun challenge because, while I do a lot of explanation with my clients about why I design things the way I do, I've never had to explain every detail. So, you know, every minute detail so frequently. So it was pretty challenging, but I think the result is worth it. I think it was worth the work. We'll see.
Did you do draft design before you started over on camera, or was it like really from scratch in the thought process?
It was really from scratch. All the way through the sixth sprint, the sixth topic, which was color, I was working completely from scratch. When I ran into that kind of roadblock in the color demonstration, I did step away and just kind of do a little bit of thinking about it. And then I came back and did it again live on camera. One of my big problems with design videos is that you'll see somebody, you know, sitting in Photoshop or Sketch or whatever, and the video is just basically fast forwarding through everything. So mm-hmm. you see like things flying around the screen and, you know, the headline gets bigger, then it gets smaller, then it gets bigger again, you know, and you don't really see why they're doing any of that stuff. So rather than fast forwarding through all that stuff, I try to show every change I make and talk about it. And I think that's where the value is. You really get experience about how a design is made that way.
That's fantastic. Yeah, because it's a lengthy process, and it's a series of micro decisions that we make right. every single 30 seconds. Really, if you explain all of that, that's a very tedious task.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, creating a design might take a day or two of work, right? So right. I didn't realize when I planned this course that, oh no, am I going to have a day or two of, like, am I going to have 48 hours of video? Because how am I going to condense 2 days of work down into a little video, right? So that was a real challenge. And I think in some ways, the design that I created in the course, it's maybe not my best work, but it does show my design process. And it does show how those decisions work. And, you know, I think it serves as a pretty solid example. But, you know, I do think that having to explain everything and record while I was doing it did affect the quality of my final design a little bit. But I think it still gets the point across. And, you know, so I'm pretty satisfied with it. I have about 10 students in early access right now taking the course. And so far, they seem to agree. So
that's great. Educational product is a product, and it has a price. And in early days, when I just started out, you were my big role model. And I read that great article where you compare your pricing with Sasha Grief's.
Oh, yeah. And thank you so much for saying that. That's so nice of you.
Yeah, really. So you charged $39 for a bootstrapping design book while Sasha was really doing something. I forgot. Probably the rate, like under $10 or something like that.
Yes,
and,
yes.
I think you've never looked back. For example, I followed your advice and I priced my first book at $39 and up with tears. Mm-hmm. And I never looked back. All my products ever since have been more expensive. What pricing thoughts have been, you know, revolving in your head throughout all these products in your life?
Yeah, so I've actually done some experiments. That Off the Chopping Block book that I mentioned, that was a lower price product, and that was an experiment for me. I was curious. It was also a shorter book than my other books. It was about half the length as the others. Mm-hmm. So I thought, you know, okay, it's shorter. I don't know if I feel right about charging more for it. But the idea is that you're charging based on value, right? What is the outcome that people are getting, and what is that worth? And I kind of broke my own rule there with that product, and I ended up regretting it, actually. That product made about $1,000 or $1,500, I think, on the first launch. It ended up making a little bit more than that later on, but not a lot. I think it maybe totaled about $3,000. And that was a pretty decent number of sales, but the book was only $20. It was half the price of my other books. So I was able to I don't think that I was able to earn more sales by reducing the price. And what ended up happening is less revenue. So, you know, that argument that Sasha had back when I wrote that really kind of a little bit rude of a critique of his idea back in that A Smart Bear article about value pricing. I think I went ahead and tried it because I thought, well, maybe I could earn more sales. And, you know, I was thinking about my audience, and a lot of people in my audience are just starting out as designers, and they're not, you know, they're not billing high rates yet. So they don't have maybe quite as much money to spend on their business as I might. So I thought, okay, I'll try a lower price product. And it ended up backfiring. And I think that it's so critical to think about the value that people are getting. Because when it comes down to it, it's not just about the dollar amount they're paying for your product. When you set your price a little bit higher, they also take your product more seriously, and they're more likely to finish using it or finish reading the book. And I found that with the lower priced product, it was just kind of an afterthought for more people. It wasn't something that they took as seriously, I guess.
Absolutely. I also have same musings inside my head because I've always gone with the higher price point. So I'm like sometimes brainstorming an idea for a cheaper product, but you see, you did it, and to lower revenue, that's the output.
Yeah, and I will say it is also possible, obviously, to go with a price that's too high. I launched a product that was basically a UI kit. It was like a front end design kit. Built in HTML and CSS. It was called Cascade. And when I launched, the product was $500. And I thought, okay, the target audience for this was, again, the same as bootstrapping design, programmers who are trying to launch a software business. And the UI kit allowed them to kind of create a customized design by changing a few variables. They could get different color schemes and different fonts and things like that. And I thought, hey, $500 for basically a customizable design is pretty good. It's more than a theme, but it's also a lot more powerful than a theme. And I realized a couple months after I launched that price or that product that price was just way too high. $500 was just too much for that audience. And I think that charging on value is kind of it's a danger in some ways because it can lead you to charge prices that are unrealistic for your audience. So I think you have to temper that advice with some really good research and data about who your audience is, how much money they can really afford to spend, and what it's really worth to them. It's not just about, well, a design is worth, you know, it could cost $10,000 if you hired a professional designer, right? $500 seems like a steal. But are those people really going to spend that $10,000 on that design? You need to know that information, right, before you price your product. So right. I think the value pricing, you have to be careful about it.
So between books and courses, I'm super happy that our, you know, our little ecosystem is fine with selling books for $39, $49, because not all people just accept that, but that's fine. You're still making money. And courses usually price higher. So what with your last course, which has video, and video instantly comes with a larger price tag. And since you have video, what price points did you pick for your last course?
Yeah, so Theory Sprints will be $199, and that is because, I mean, as I mentioned, it has 4 hours of video content. It's not just because it's a bigger product. It's also because it teaches you a lot more. You know, my that first book that I did, Bootstrapping Design, it was really more of an introduction, and in, I think, 20,000 words that I had in that book, I really felt like I barely scratched the surface. And Theory Sprints is meant for people who are at the beginning of a career or they're already in their career. And this is a product for people who are making a serious investment into themselves, you know. So that price reflects it because it's not just about you know, it's not for tourists, I guess is what I'm saying. It's not for entertainment. It's not a fun, quick read. The course demands a lot of effort, you know, to really improve as a designer. It takes some work. So the course is, you know, it's $200 because there's a lot that goes into teaching design, and there's a lot of content there. And, you know, I also have other things in the course, like project briefs that give people an opportunity to practice and things like that. They'll also get a monthly office hour session with me, so I can critique their work and answer questions. And all of those things are more valuable than just a quick book, you know, a book that you can read in just a couple hours on a Saturday afternoon or something, right? So it's a much bigger thing.
Absolutely. In terms of the format, there are multiple platforms out there that allow you to package video courses. I don't know, Teachable, previously Fedora, a couple other platforms. You can also just sell video through Gumroad or as a pack. How do you package up your course?
Yeah, my course is running on WordPress using mm-hmm. a variety of plugins. I use the Restrict Content Pro membership plugin, and that handles, you know, making sure that, you know, people who aren't logged in can't access the content and things like, you know, the purchase process, the purchase flow, all of that stuff. And then I also use a plugin by Paul Jarvis and Zach Gilbert called mm-hmm. WP Complete, which basically turns my WordPress theme into an LMS. So it allows people to mark each lesson in the course as completed, and it gives them kind of a progress bar showing how much of the course they've completed. And on top of that, I also, because I'm a designer and a developer, I built my own custom WordPress theme for the course. So it, I was able to kind of customize the way the WordPress site looks and everything so that it looks and feels like an online course.
That sounds
and
great.
I decided to mm-hmm. go that way just because my audience is designers, and I think they'll respond better to something more custom rather than just having something on one of those existing platforms. Not that there's anything wrong with those, of course.
Mm-hmm. Sounds great. Okay, I think we covered main topics, and that was super valuable. Where
Thank
can
you.
People find you online?
Yeah, so my website is studiofellow.com, and I'm also on Twitter, same handle, just at studiofellow.
Why did you pick that name? I've always been curious.
Oh, it was just a name that I came up with. The idea is fellow. I like that idea because it's about people, you know, having things in common. You know, it's about your fellow designers. And I think my goal as a designer is to help people. You know, it's to do work that improves people's lives. So the idea for Studio Fellow was it's about, you know, helping my fellow man, I guess, and helping fellow designers and teaching and sharing. So that was where the idea came from.
Awesome. That new course that you are talking about, where can we find that?
Yeah, so when it launches, you'll be able to find info on my website at studiofellow.com.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for making the time. I think whoever sets out for an educational product now has much more information to guide their decision thanks to your advice.
Perfect. Thanks so much for having me. This was a blast.
Yeah, thank you. Have a great day.
Thanks.